Blog Talk Radio.
Morning. This is Three Women, Three Ways. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're the radio show that talks about news events, women's issues, current events, everything that you want to talk about, we talk about, and we view it from our three different perspectives. My name is Heather Stark, and I am here. I kind of have taken the moniker of the academic for right now because I'm working on my dissertation for my PhD in organizational psychology, and I've been interested in the area of domestic violence for about 12 years, 13 years now, and find it an absolutely fascinating field. Everybody thinks it's depressing, and it is, but there's also a lot of positive stuff about it, and that is one of the things that we're going to talk about today. But first, let me introduce you to Deborah Adams. She is my co-host today. Deborah, tell us about yourself a little bit.
Good morning, Heather, and good morning, listeners. It is a great day, and we're excited about our guest. But before we bring that subject up, I'll introduce myself. I'm Deborah. I live in Southwest Washington State, and my tagline is I have lived it, I have studied it, and I have worked it. And I'm talking about domestic violence specifically, but also many other forms of violence against women. So I am with Heather in the fact that I think education is important. I am a late bloomer with that. I returned to college when my youngest son started his college career. So one thing I like to say about us is we got our bachelor degrees in the same year. So not many mother-son duos can have that claim to fame. But
I didn't know that about you, Deborah, because I went back to school the same year my youngest started college.
Yeah.
But I graduated first.
Good
okay,
for
sorry
you.
To interrupt there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting. I remember asking my son, oh, maybe we'll go to the community college together. And he's like, no, we won't, Mom.
Maybe we could major in the same thing.
Yeah. So I stayed in town and he left. And I see that our caller is on the phone, Heather.
Okay, let me give a little introduction. Hi, Rob, are you there for us?
I am. How are
you
doing?
Okay, let me just give a very brief introduction. I'm going to let you talk about yourself mostly. And Rob Oken is editor and founder of Voicemail Magazine out of Massachusetts. And one of the exciting things that I was talking about that we are going to share with you today is some of the work that men are doing in the anti-violence against women field. And Rob, you're kind of our expert today, and I'm going to let you give us a little background on how you came to be interested in this field.
Sure. Well, I'm happy to be on the show. I guess the first thing that I want to say is that for the longest time, there's been a growing number of men who have recognized the leadership and the hard work that women have done over the last several decades in the modern-day women's movement to put the issue of violence against women front and center in people's consciousness. And I think that for as much work still is to be done, there's been a lot that we can feel good about. And I think although it took a long time, the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, the renewal of that, I think the way that finally shook out is a good indication that things are moving in a better direction. And I guess for a lot of men, we didn't quite get it, what was happening when the women's movement, the modern-day women's movement, was starting up 40, 50 years ago.
Not that you're old enough to remember.
What's that?
Not that you're old enough to remember.
Well, I have to acknowledge that I was a teen coming up, and I think I actually am someone who generationally caught the wave of a lot of issues simultaneously, so that the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the environmental movement, the gay rights movement, and the women's movement all were kind of within a few years of each other coming into my consciousness as a older teen heading off to college. And I think in some regards, for me anyway, it made a difference in how I was able to see all of these isms and see all of these movements as part of a whole rather than just being in the silo of the anti-war movement or just being in the silo of the civil rights movement. So one of the earliest memories as a first-year college student was seeing that while there was a lot of anti-war activity going on, I was in Washington, D.C. at school. What I recognized early on was that the women who were involved in the anti-war movement were not being given or taking leadership positions. And I think the first inkling that something wasn't right came to my consciousness that there was a disparity in how the women were being treated, even though many of them were the most articulate and the most strategic and the most thoughtful. So that kind of just started to plant a seed. And as I went through my own evolution, I recognized that women's rights were just as important in my thinking about social issues and political issues as were civil rights. And I think, you know, where we are today with seeing what's happened in the last couple of months and around the gay marriage issue and just gay rights in general, that the wheel is turning towards social justice. You know, Dr. King is famously noted for saying that the arc of history bends towards justice, and I think we're seeing more of that. And for pro-feminist men, joining women in the work of ending violence against women and girls and ending violence against other men and recognizing the narrow and rigid restricted lives that we've been leading as men because our socialization has not allowed us to develop a real wide palette of emotional expressiveness, that we find ourselves in a situation where a small but growing number of men is saying, hey, what these women have been doing for these last several decades, that's good stuff. And the door, the doorway that they pushed open, the portal that they pushed open, saying we want our emancipation, we want our full citizenship, we want all of our rights, there was nothing on that door that said women only. This is a doorway to come through if you want to lead a fully emancipated life. And some of us were very reluctant. We were scared. The landscape was changing under our feet. We were stumbling around. And then we came in through the doorway and we recognized that, wow, this is really a good place to be because we can talk more deeply than about you know, sports or cars or politics or whatever, that we can actually connect with what's going on inside, and we can have as rich interior lives as we're having exterior lives. So it didn't happen all at once, and it didn't happen perfectly for many of us, but over these last, for men, I'd say the last 20, 25 years, this movement that I call pro-feminism. I know that there's a debate about whether men can be feminists, and I come down on the side that I describe myself as pro-feminist, and that term is restricted to women. I know other people feel differently. But those semantic questions aside, this larger question of why have not more men said the issue of violence against women is a men's issue, or beyond that, well, it's a community issue. Why haven't they done that?
One of the signs that I saw when I was just doing a little news search earlier this week, that there are some things that are starting to pop up that kind of surprised me. One is that the Dallas Cowboys, or I guess the city of Dallas, The mayor declared last month and had a rally, and there were hundreds of men in front of City Hall who pledged to end the domestic violence issue, and it included some of the Dallas Cowboys and some of the coaches, former coaches.
Yeah.
And I think we typically think of sports as a particularly difficult area when it comes to violence against women. Has that been part of your findings?
Yes, and I think that the news out of Dallas, and particularly the mayor initiating this, if you go to the City of Dallas's website, it's quite a impressive story about what he's done and his level of initiating anti-domestic violence efforts and a whole host of issues that those of us who are promoting a more progressive political agenda. So, and to see athletes joining in, there has been a steady stream of athletes who have been speaking out more. The New York Yankees and Los Angeles Dodgers former manager Joe Torre, who grew up in a home where he witnessed domestic violence by his father against his mother, he started a foundation called Safe at Home, and he's been very active. More football players are being active. There's a very important program called MVP, Mentors in Violence Prevention, which is a play on the term Most Valuable Player, the award that's given out in sports. Mentors in Violence Prevention, that a colleague and friend of mine, Jackson Katz, who you're probably familiar with.
Sure.
That he and others co-founded at the Center for Sports and Society at Northeastern University in Boston about 25 years ago. They do trainings with professional sports teams as well as with the military, which is another area where violence against women has been pretty much at epidemic proportions. I don't know if some of your listeners have seen or read about the documentary film The Invisible War about the treatment of female military personnel. It was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary, and I just was at an event at one of the area colleges here in Amherst, Massachusetts, the other night, where the journalist and activist Helen Benedict, who'd written this book, The Lonely Soldier, that was the impetus for this film, The Invisible War, which I highly recommend.
This is Deborah, Rob, and we actually brought that to the attention of our listeners about 2 weeks ago, didn't we, Heather?
Okay.
Yes, it was a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we tend to look at news through our lens, which is very much as how does this impact us through our lens of violence prevention and anti-violence work. Rob, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Because I have a brother, he's older than I am, and I think he too would identify as a feminist, and he was probably more feminist than I was when we were in that teenage years that you were talking about. I'm curious to hear what you think. What would tend to lead men to be pro-feminist early on? Do you think it's their life experience, or?
I think, catching, this is a really good question. I think catching younger men when their sense of justness and fair play hasn't been tainted by outside forces. Particularly when I say that, I mean how we're socialized as males. That there's this assumption that the privilege and the entitlement that we carry around as men, a lot of us, until it's pointed out or until we have some incidents where we see the blatant discrimination, we just presume this is just how life is. We're male, and we get these set of privileges. We don't really question it. There's that old expression, you know, the fish don't see the water that they're swimming in. Maleness as the norm, I put in quotes around that, is just how most guys see the world.
Yep.
Just as whiteness is how most white people see the world. Because when we say words like race, we think people of color, and when we say words like gender, we think women. Because the majority, the quote-unquote norm, are those other two groups, whites and men. And what
right.
those of us are who are recognizing you know, the need for kind of revamping and recasting and transforming our society, recognizing that this gender disparity has been a huge impediment to social progress. The biggest thing that we have to step forward and say we want to be in on this movement, I mean, the biggest thing that we as men have to get over is this fear that if we give up our power and privilege and our entitlement, that somehow our lives are diminished, when just the reverse is the case. Our lives open up when we
mm-hmm.
share, when we recognize that the burden of feeling that we're supposed to be the provider, the breadwinner. Look at the statistics of men's health. It's appalling. We don't go to the doctor. We don't go to the therapist. We don't take care of ourselves. And as a consequence, our health issues, you know, high blood pressure and heart disease and our life expectancy, you stack that up against women and the stats for women, and you'd say, gee, if this is what being the so-called superior gender is, then count me out.
How can I change that?
Yeah.
Let me interject here
sure.
for a moment. We have a phone number if you'd like to join us in this conversation. It is 646. Oh, excuse me, I sneezed. But it is 646-378-0430. That is 646-378-0430. We'd love for you to join us on this conversation. Rob, sorry for interrupting you.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I mean, you know, a couple of colleagues and I were having this conversation, and it continues to be perplexing, but somehow there's something insidious about how the whole idea of recognizing that there are pro-feminist men, that there are a lot of men working on the anti-violence work, that all of that's going on, but it doesn't get reported on. And we've been having this conversation. It's like, what is it about what we're doing that the mainstream media doesn't want us to be part of the conversation? Why don't they report on it? And an example that I would give is the gun debate that's heated up. It's started to warm up again after the tragedy at the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado last summer, and then the attacks and the murders at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin outside of Milwaukee, and then hit that awful, awful day on December 14th of last year when the 20 children and the staff members at the school were murdered. And, of course, the first person who was murdered was the man's mother. So this story began as a domestic violence murder and grew into this mass murder. But virtually nowhere in the national debate that's followed has the issue of gender been raised. And even though the ones who were raising it are the pro-feminist male activists who've been writing that, don't you see this? Who were the shooters in all of these cases? In 62 out of 63 mass shootings going back way before Columbine, isn't there something that we ought to be looking at here? What is it about our society that is producing a tiny minority of one gender who are these disaffected, lonely, alienated, hurt, wounded, disturbed men. What are we going to do about that? And for those
of
us who... Go ahead.
I was just reading a little article by Nina Burley. She's a journalist and author of the book The Fatal Gift of Beauty. And she calls it misogynist bullying. She says in all the publicity about bullying, everybody's missing the fact that it's misogynist bullying, that for the most part there are, you know, young women who are being bullied by guys, whether all the way to a rape scenario like we saw, you know, last week with the young Canadian girl. It's basically a form of bullying, but nobody's talking about it as such.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with her, too. I mean, this is... Say her name again so both I and the listeners can pick up on this. Nina Burley?
Nina Burley, B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H.
Okay, and it's the her book is
The Fatal Gift of Beauty.
The Fatal Gift of Beauty. I mean, this is part of what we're up against, and it's why we really need more men to step up, is that while situations like bullying are not restricted to males, it's true that the vast, vast majority of the perpetrators of bullying are male, and that we're unwilling as a society at this point to put a gender on some of these social issues and to name men as the perpetrators. I love men. If I got cut off, if we couldn't continue this conversation, the message that I want to leave with the listeners is believe in men. Believe in our capacity to grow, to heal, to be better than what we have started out to be, to take all of the great things about being male, our sense of responsibility and our physical strength and our courage, and then integrate them with developing a sense of compassion, developing our nurturing abilities, and developing our listening skills. But men are also the greatest victims of violence, you know, numerically. So
primarily male against male violence?
Right.
Yes.
Right. I mean, if you look at, you know, the murders and robberies and assaults, just by the numbers, but we don't even talk about that as an issue.
Right.
Because rightly so. I mean, I think the alarm, you know, has been sounding around what's been happening in our homes and in family violence and the unparalleled, you know, case after case after case. And we're not... Why are we reluctant to put the gender of the perpetrators of violence front and center in our conversation? I think all of the debates, and I think having it's so heart-wrenching to hear the parents from Newtown. One of them President Obama gave up his weekly radio address he gave to one of the Newtown parents, a mom of the little boy Benjamin Wheeler. I think it's great to be having their voice in the conversation. But if we're only talking about gun violence, or if we're only talking about assault weapons, or if we're only talking about background checks, and if we're only talking about, you know, Hollywood movies or violent video games, or if we're only talking about mental illness, then we're missing a core of what needs to happen, which is to start at the beginning with little boys and cultivate their emotional intelligence.
That has to be supported by the environment as well. I don't think, you know, as a mother who considered herself feminist who raised a son, I don't think we can do it alone. I think it has to be supported, especially by the media. And one of the things that interested me this week is Reebok, of course, the shoe manufacturer, dropped Rick Ross Now, I'm not familiar with Rick Ross, but I do know that he's a musician and does a lot of songs, and a lot of them are pretty violent against women.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Reebok actually came out and dumped him. And they said that the date rape lyric that he had was very controversial, and that he doesn't follow their image. And so he's failed. What they said was, while we do not believe that Rick Ross condones sexual assault, we are very disappointed he has yet to display an understanding of the seriousness of this issue or an appropriate level of remorse.
See, that's the kind of statement, and that's the kind of sense of corporate responsibility that we need to go after and say, you know, thanks for beginning, keep going,
mm-hmm.
keep going. Make it part of your corporate culture. So I think those things, sometimes these companies start from a place of, oh, this is a politically expedient decision. We'll look good if we make this decision and dump him. And then we'll get talked about on feminist radio shows, and we'll get written up as being a good company. And our competitor, Nike, that's been getting all this bad press about their horrific child labor exploitation in third world countries, will gain from this. But that's maybe a little bit of a cynical place to start. But frankly, if that's what motivates a company to start, and then they get approached by organizations that are doing beyond the ground work and get to see that there's a movement behind them, then they'll start to do the right thing. This is the thing about men, and even men, powerful white men. If you can make the case, if you make the case to them, they're willing to change. They're willing to listen, because just as men are hurting others, men are hurting inside themselves. And so many of us, for so long, have been holding at bay any real effort to break down what's been going on in our interior lives and to see how impoverished we've been emotionally. And so much of what we do to keep that at bay is to either self-medicate or to take out those feelings on others. And I think something like the story that you just cited from Reebok is one of those little chinks in the tremendous armor that men wear.
But at the same time, yesterday Harvard had their annual spring music concert, and they headlined a 23-year-old musician, rapper, I don't know exactly the proper terminology, but just in just two lines of one of his songs, you've got the F word four times.
Mm-hmm.
And, skank. And, I mean, his music is just full of misogyny and violence. And yet Harvard picked him for their spring music concert, which is,
right.
is pretty renowned.
And right.
when they were kind of accosted for it, or questioned about it, the Harvard basically said, "Well, all the students know that it's just off the grid, and most people who listen to their music understand that the songs are just too ridiculous to be taken at face value." And that's a direct quote.
That
really?
from someone in the PR department at Harvard?
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
So let's keep following that story. Can you email me that link? I'd love to follow up on that for something. What I haven't shared with the listeners, and we haven't really talked about, is that the magazine that I publish and edit, voicemailmagazine.org, and male, of course, is spelled like the gender, voicemale, M-A-L-E, magazine.org, that we describe it as a publication that's talking about the transformation or the redefinition of masculinity. So we're both reporting on the things that are troubling to us that we need to be challenging, but we also are reporting on and chronicling this social transformation. And whenever there's some good news, and my hunch is that the students, both male and female, maybe primarily initially led by some of the women in kind of gender justice collectives on campus, that there's going to be some blowback, and that the spokesperson for the college who made such a ridiculous statement as that is going to find, I'm assuming it's a himself, he's going to find himself having to change his tune, because the tide is turning. There's no question that we're going to keep hearing bad news. I mean, what happened to that young medical student on the bus in Delhi in India in December is one of the most horrific stories of gang rape. And what happened in terms of that being to India what Newtown was to the U.S. in terms of putting an issue front and center in the public consciousness. There wasn't a cafe or a restaurant or a newspaper or a radio or conversations on the bus. I have colleagues who were there at the time, that more men have spoken out in that culture about what happened. So things are still going to happen. Bad news is going to happen. All we have to do is go to bed and we'll wake up in the morning and there will be bad news. And it's our responsibility, and thank you for producing a show like this, to have more and more opportunities for the change to be illuminated. There's a wonderful philosopher and ecologist and feminist activist, Buddhist practitioner from Berkeley, Joanna Macy, who is, if you haven't seen or read any of her books, listeners, she's just has a wide swath of interests and has popularized a term that a man named David Corin coined, which is the Great Turning. And Joanna, when she speaks, is speaking about what's happening on every front, from the environmental movement to the gay rights movement to the women's movement to the pro-feminist movement, pro-feminist men's movement. There is a great turning underway, and it is turning towards that arc of justice that Dr. King spoke about. It doesn't mean that it's easy, and it doesn't mean that we don't need more hands on deck and more shoulders to the wheel of change, but it's happening. And I just feel that as younger men, whether in high school or in college, as they start to connect the dots, if they don't get insulated into a culture that is supporting misogyny, if they get into a culture that is questioning misogyny, then this wheel of change is going to continue to turn. You know how we have certain words that have a kind of a gender, a natural idea of gender comes to them. So if we say compassion and caring, we think female. And if we say, you know, courageous and heroic, we think male, even though it's kind of ridiculous that both genders can embody all of those traits. Still, I'm pushing for a world where men redefine what their definition is of courage. So, for example, most of us, when we say, you know, what's a courageous act, we might think of the firefighter, the male firefighter rushing out of the building, you know, that's in flames, carrying the little babies to safety. And that's a fine image. And of course, when we go back to 9/11, we know that there were lots and lots of female rescue workers who were involved. So it's not even fair to look at those people and those professions as male. But when I speak, I often ask, what happens when a bunch of guys are standing around and one of them starts to make a homophobic or a racist or a sexist remark or tell some joke that's disparaging of women or gays or people of color, what do you do? Do you just look down? Do you just mumble, I have to go, and absent yourself from the situation? Or do you look that the bigot in the eye and say, you know what? I don't like that. I don't like listening to that, and I don't want to be around that. And to me, that is as courageous an act as anything else a man can do.
Absolutely.
So I'd love it if somebody went up to that singer at the Harvard concert and said, that's trash. You know, if you can't give us something better than that, why don't you pack up your gear and get out of here?
Yeah. Rob, I found a blog that you wrote on the V-Day site, and I also read a recent writing of yours on the explodedview.org website where mm-hmm. you're talking about, now can we talk about masculinity in men? And so did you see the Eve Ensler live stream talk where she talked to some other male leaders like yourselves who share similar views with you?
Yes, she moderated that panel. Yes, those are all
yeah.
colleagues of mine. It was a wonderful. In fact, if you have that the specifics of that, I would invite any of your listeners to spend as much time as they can watching that, because it was a wonderful program a couple weeks ago in New York, where Eve Ensler, the founder of V-Day, and the activist and the playwright, moderated a conversation with, I think it was four other guys, Jimmy Briggs from Man Up, Joe Ehrman from Coach for America, Dave Zirin, the progressive sports critic and sports columnist who has this thing called Edge of Sports, and Peter Buffett, the composer and the co-chair of the Novo Foundation, a foundation that supports anti-violence activities. They spoke for, and Tony Porter from an organization called A Call to Men.
Yes.
They spoke for a couple of hours and hit on all the topics.
Well, here's what I kind of got from that, because towards the end, a woman in the audience says, what can women do to support men or to work better with men, collaborate better with men? And I'm not sure which of the – well, they all had really good responses, but I think it was Tony who said that, I think you've done as much as you can, and now it's up to us as men.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that comment?
Well, I think it's I agree that I'm of two minds. I mean, we should not expect, men should not expect women to continue to do all the heavy lifting in changing a culture where domestic violence and sexual violence are as prevalent as they are. We have to play a very active role as men in interrupting and not condoning and not staying silent to and working towards ending or preventing or lessening. So that's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that makes me feel hopeful and is part of this great turning is that the level of collaboration and shared projects among women and men is at a high point. And Eve Ensler, who was on the National Advisory Board of Voicemail Magazine, I should say.
Nice.
She's a great proponent of that collaboration. So it's both and. Yes, men should be working with women on these issues, and men should not expect women to be doing all the heavy lifting, that it's really up to us. And when we talk about all these issues, it's really important for us to remember that the majority of men are not abusive. The majority of men are not violent. The majority of men are not
rapists, but by our silence, by our unwillingness to take this on any level, by our throwing up our hands and saying, that's awful, and walking away,
yep.
We're seeding the ground to the perpetrators of violence. And
yep.
Somehow, and then the public gets this perception that the numbers, that this is how men feel. This isn't how men feel. That's why when I say believe in men, believe in our capacity to grow and to change and to heal, but we have to speak up. Believe in
right.
our capacity to speak up, because we're not doing it.
Well,
yeah,
along those same lines, Rob, I'm thinking, kind of flashing back to that Steubenville rape case with football players.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you listened to that little 10-minute piece that was on the internet, but what struck me about that, besides, you know, obvious dislike of the whole thing, was that during that recording, most of the boys were, and I say boys on purpose, most of the boys were laughing and joking and making derogatory remarks about the drunken 16-year-old. But at one point in the background, you hear a young man's voice saying, "What if she were your sister?" And I thought they just kind of poo-pooed him, and they kept going with what, you know, with their nonsense. But to me, I thought, now that took courage for this
yep.
kid to tell his peer group, to try to get to his peer group and make an impression and try to get them to behave more responsibly. That really took courage.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, and it was like outrageous that should have gotten highlighted, you know, and it didn't. And
no.
I think, you know, the unbelievable, I mean, people, you know, have this highfalutin impression of CNN as being, you know, the height of objective journalism.
Yeah, they kind of bossed it, didn't they?
They certainly did. Talking about the destroyed lives and the difficult lives that these promising young athletes have now
yeah.
put them, you know, what's going to happen to them, expressing all the sympathy for them
and
not saying anything about what happened to the victim, to this young woman who was unconscious and was being carted around. I mean, this is where the voices that should be speaking up and challenging in those moments should be male voices. And
yeah,
I'm not saying that
Steubenville was
that
like a hotbed of...
What's that?
Steubenville, the furor around that was like a hotbed of activism, but it was also a fertile field for a lot of victim blaming.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of bad behavior by a lot of people. I mean, I was really disappointed in the defense attorney that claimed that, well, she was drunk, so she gave consent. I mean, talk about the height of victim blaming and sort of a stance of ignorance. I mean, I know it's their job to defend the men on trial, but I just thought, wasn't there some other way he could have defended them?
Yep.
Without going to, I mean, certainly anybody who drinks alcohol does not have an expectation that they will be raped.
Correct.
Is not implied consent for any kind of inappropriate sexual behavior. And how we have come to have raised our young men to think that that is an expectation or that it's an accepted reality is just, you know, it's disheartening to me. Rob, I have two sons, and I have two son-in-laws, and I have three grandsons, as well as two daughters and all that.
Uh-huh.
So I do believe in men, and I certainly believe in the fact that men have compassion. I've seen it time and time again in my children and my grandchildren and my brothers and my male role models. But whenever I try to hold a male accountable, whether it is in my family circle or my friend circle, the first thing that happens is I get shut down as being, oh, you're just a feminist, or oh, you're just whatever.
Or you're a man-hater.
You're a man-hater.
Yeah.
I find that really hard, that kind of silencing, and I'm a really outspoken woman, and I usually don't let that stop me. But, I mean, you hear it so often that it does give me rise to think maybe I shouldn't always be the voice out there.
Well,
what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, first off, I'm reluctant to give advice to a woman.
I don't blame you.
Because that's what men think we're really good at, and we've certainly proven otherwise. And I think, you know, a great response for a comment like that is like, I'm a violence hater, you know,
yeah.
I'm an abuse hater, I'm a, you know, a rape hater. And then I think it's very disarming and it's very disconcerting for anyone to hear someone say, you know, I have compassionate sons and, you know, I have men in my life. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about that I'm against men.
Right, it's not against
them. I'm against behavior like this. And frankly, I'm disappointed when, you know, when my guys in my life who I know, that they don't speak up more. Because it's not enough to speak privately to me about how they agree with my positions. You have to say it. So
mm-hmm.
I want these guys, the mayor of Dallas, you know, he's in the heart of Texas. He's in George Bush and Karl Rove country, and he's willing to, you know, try to put a different spin. Texas is probably one of the hardest places to invite that kind of change, and this guy's choosing to do it.
Yeah.
And he's giving cover to, you know, so the cowboys, come on down, you know, get involved and bring your buddies from the Texas Rangers and the Houston Astros, bring them along. We're heading in the right direction. We're going to keep running into roadblocks, and we have to work on many fronts. You know, a lot of activists have kind of thrown up their hands at the state legislators and the U.S. Congress and elected officials in that way. And I can
yeah.
certainly understand that some people are saying, I'm going to, you know, work in my local community, or I'm going to, you know, build the kind of society I want by partnering with the kinds of people that I want to work with. And we have to also, you know, keep our eyes open and look to the people who are willing to step into that incredibly difficult legislative fray and all of the craziness of state legislatures or the U.S. Congress, and be willing to support them. A lot of progressive people got elected this past fall, you know, from Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin as the first openly lesbian U.S. senator. I mean, I think that was a huge step forward. So we have to move forward on multiple fronts and keep kind of looking for places to renew ourselves. It's like how the hybrid car industry, they're looking to have these charging units, you know. Well, the activists, we need to find these places to charge up and to get on renewables, you know, our renewable activist energy supply. And for me, you know, publishing voicemail magazine is one of those places where I get my inspiration from some of the people who write for the magazine and some of the ideas that we are promoting in the magazine.
This would be a good time, Rob, to talk about how did you decide to start Voicemail Magazine?
Oh, well, that's a good story. In my community in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is in the western part of the state, it's about a half an hour south of the Vermont-New Hampshire borders, a very beautiful part of the New England countryside.
there, in 1982, a men's center got started, initially called the Men's Resource Connection, and then at one point called the Men's Resource Center of Western Massachusetts, and finally settling on, as it kept growing, the Men's Resource Center for Change. And inside of all of the activities going on was a little newsletter that had the name Valley Men. And 20-some years ago, I showed up on the scene, having had my first career as a journalist and a newspaper reporter and a magazine editor. And I recognized that this little newsletter could be more than that. It could actually start to report on not just what this one center in Massachusetts was doing, but on the work that was going on in Oakland with the Oakland Men's Project, or going on in Washington with the Men Can Stop Rape, or going on in Atlanta with Men Stopping Violence, and over the years, A Call to Men in New York, and on, Man Up, also in New York, Mentors in Violence and Prevention that I mentioned. So over time, I said, let's see if we can ramp up the newsletter and convert it into a magazine. Excuse me. And with the support and the endorsement from the others in the organization, I changed the name from Valley Men to Voicemail, started to get some outside writers to contribute, increased our initial print run from 1,000 to 10,000, and kept growing the magazine. And then about 5 years ago, when I stepped down as the executive director of the Men's Resource Center, my kind of takeaway from the board of directors was keep the magazine going. That was kind of my charge. They didn't have anyone on staff who had a background in publishing and editing. I was looking to do less than the administrative work of running the center, and it was a good marriage, so to speak. And since that time, I've been publishing the magazine independently and working on both the online and the print version, having it available at major conferences and lots of nonprofit organizations, particularly colleges and universities and state domestic violence and sexual assault prevention coalitions are getting contracts to have the magazines available for staff and constituents and other stakeholders. So it's been a great story, and I'm happy to say that in the fall, I'm publishing a book based on a kind of an anthology based on what's been in the magazine over the last more than a quarter century. And it's called Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. It'll be coming out either in October or November from Interlink Books. And people can find out about it either through interlinkbooks.com or at the voicemailmagazine.org website, or they can write me directly at rob@voicemailmagazine.org.
Thank you for that. And I have, you know, I'm kind of a regular reader of the online version, and I love it. I learn something new every time I read Voicemail. And I'm impressed by the quality of the contributors, too, quite frankly. So it's a good magazine to have access to.
Thank you.
I'm pleased because there's a growing list of contributors, as you said, Rob, and it's men's voices from around the world, right? It's not just a U.S. issue. It's a world issue.
That's
so
right. That's right.
I'm grateful for the magazine and pleased to see the number of men participating in that. I think it's awesome.
Thank you.
Well, and you were talking, I guess coming full circle, when we started out this conversation, we were kind of talking about athletes and the military, both of which have a reputation for being, you know, aggressive and probably more violent than normal. One of the things that I found, you mentioned a call to men as an organization in this movement, Rob, but it looks like with the call to men and Verizon Foundation just announced that they are going to bring a national domestic violence prevention training program to coaches in Baltimore, and they hope to expand that. So there's a big emphasis in the movement right now to work with the professional sports and organizations. Is this do you see real progress here? Do you see this as a problem area that really needs to be worked?
Well, I there certainly is domestic violence and sexual assault is pervasive in all kinds of settings in professions that don't get the kind of notoriety or, you know, are not part of the popular culture like the sports industry. So I think the upside of all of this is that because so many people are interested in their sports heroes, if some of the more renowned athletes are willing to become educated and become spokespeople to challenge behaviors of this minority of men, then that's a great thing. I mean, nobody is doing trainings for, you know, accountants or, you know, other professions, even though those are, you know, areas where the violence and assaults can be happening. So we look to these guys, we look to our athletes to speak out, and we hope that the impression, well, young people in particular are going to see, hey, I want to go and be like him, not like the guy who's, you know, harassing and being demeaning and you know, suggestive of all kinds of negative behaviors. So, yeah, I'm feeling good about that. And the work that Joe Ehrman does in his program, Coach for America, and the work that Mentors in Violence Prevention, MVP, does in the sports, we got to come at it with as many tools as we have. And this is great news that Verizon and A Call to Men are partnering to work in Baltimore. That's great.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that has really impressed me,
if you had heard about the Heather and I both live in Washington State, and one of our state coalitions has partnered with the Mariners on their Refuse Abuse campaign. Have you heard about that?
Say the campaign again.
It's Refuse to Abuse campaign, and it's the Seattle Mariners and one of our state coalitions. It's a project they've had in place for, I want to say about 12 years.
That's great.
And each year they usually find one or two spokesmen from the group, and they target males like 12 to 26, I want to say.
Yeah.
And their slogans are something like, it's never okay to strike a woman. You know,
right.
It's real base-oriented.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there are so many of these things starting to pop up. It really gives me a sense of hope. And, Rob, you've been doing this for 25, 30 years now, and do you feel that same sense of hope?
I do. I have to say that even though there are these setbacks and they're kind of inevitable, the movement is growing, the consciousness is growing, and I do feel a sense of hope.
Good.
We can't let up, and we can't. I want. It's a little bit discouraging sometimes to see high school and college age young women shying away from identifying as feminist, and that the word has gotten kind of viewed as archaic in some regard, and then you ask them all of these these things that have been attained, these achievements, and these things that they expect in their lives, you know, that their foremothers worked so hard, that you guys worked so hard to achieve, and they're defining themselves as feminists without using the language. And I think that we've got to both invite them to rethink that aversion towards the word and to proudly to wear it, but we also have to have them encourage more of their male counterparts to get in there.
Good. Rob, we have had such a good time today, but our time is running out. I thank you for being here with us. We always end our show with a quote. Deborah, do you have a quote for us today?
I do have a quote, and it's from D.H. Lawrence. He says, "Time being, after all, only the current of the soul in its flow." And that's what we have is time, and we need to use it wisely.
Good. Thank you so much
for listening.
Yep.
We
thank
are
you,
three
Rob.
Women.
We are three ways, and we are three divas.
Divas.
Join us next week.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you so much.